This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features a narration from the Essential Sosanko, a collection of chess portraits and personal stories authored by chess grandmaster Gena Sosanko. The subject of this week's story is Latvian international master Alvis Vidalins. Alvis was born in Riga, like his compatriot Miša Tal, and this was not all they shared in common. Like Tal, Vidalins was known for his brilliant sacrificial play. However, due to some personal hardships, he never reached the title of grandmaster. He also did not play many international tournaments. However, in Latvia, he shone, winning several championships. He was also known for his contributions to the poison pawn variation of the Sicilian, which was extremely popular during that time. Enjoy this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast.
Alvis Vidalins, The Jump, continued. Tall, very big, with long side whiskers, in his young years, he resembled the famous American who was almost his namesake, Elvis. As he grew older, his facial features became sharper. Here and there, deep lines appeared. His side whiskers became even longer, and he came to look more like the skipper of an English cargo ship of the 19th century. And still, in Vidalins's appearance, one sensed something strange and languid. He was as though not of this world, with his inadequate, often unpredictable reactions, and his strange laugh. In his youth, this was not so marked, but with the years, these features became ever more obvious. By nature, he was honest, naive, and kind. That smile that sometimes stole over his face made him look childlike and defenseless. All his life, Alvis essentially remained a big child. As often happens with this type of people, he was physically very strong. When the doctor advised him to take up some sport, he, an individualist by nature, acquired a 7-kilogram shot and every day threw it on his farmstead. He did this with passion, rejoicing over improvements in his results and taking his personal record, so it is said, up to 13 meters. He did not have any close friends. He avoided people, especially strangers, and especially those who were not chess players. At tournaments, he was often seen in the company of Karen Gregorian, brackets 1947 to 1989, close brackets. Karen Gregorian's father was the outstanding Armenian poet Ashot Grashi, and his mother was a professor of philology. Very intelligent and well-read, from childhood, Karen could cite many poets from memory. His favourite image in literature was Lermontov's demon, and in painting, Vrubel's demon. Karen grew up as a highly sensitive and vulnerable boy, with a subtle feeling for art. It is hard to say how his fate would have turned out had he followed in the footsteps of his parents, but at the age of 7, the boy became devoted to chess. He possessed a striking, versatile talent and was considered the chess hope of Armenia. In the 70s, Karen Gregorian regularly took part in the finals of the USSR Championship. Like Vidalins, he did not seem to belong to this world. Perhaps not so morose as Alvis, but also strange, unusual, not like others. It's curious that Karen studied for a time with Lev Aronin, an outstanding player and theoretician who was also burdened with serious mental problems. One of the critical games in Aronin's chess career was his meeting with Smyslov in the 19th USSR Championship in 1951. It was adjourned in a position where practically any move would have led to a win for White. However, Aronin, who had a whole day for analysis, went into a pawn ending, which allowed his opponent a study-like way to save the game. Karen later remembered that whenever he called in on him, Aronin would be sitting in that position, pensively moving the pieces about. One of Karen's favourite questions was, "What do you think which tournament was stronger, Nottingham 1936 or the 1973 USSR Championship?" Karen asked it regularly, grasping the other person by the elbow and looking him in the eye. In that tournament in 1973, one of the strongest in the entire history of USSR championships, he played splendidly. By present-day standards, Karen was a strong grandmaster. After winning two successive games in a USSR championship or an international tournament, he would consider himself a genius and would readily set up a link. Yesterday, I won against Tal. Of course, Tal is no longer world champion, but he has a positive score against Fischer. What do you think about my chances in a match with Fischer? The following day, after losing a game, he could become dejected and depressed, repeating that his own play was repulsive to him, that his life was of no use to anyone. He would begin talking about suicide long before he became a patient at a psychiatric hospital and long before that final freefall jump from the highest bridge in Yerevan on October 30, 1989. The friendship between Grigorian and Vitalins was not a friendship in the generally accepted sense of the word. Shut off from the other world, they simply understood each other, or more correctly, trusted each other. They intuitively felt that the other was a kindred soul who, after a conversation with you, does not go off and begins retelling its content with an ironic smile. And of course, in their world, chess, which they both loved selflessly, played the most important role. Both Alvis Vitalins and Karen Grigorian were outstanding masters of blitz, while in tournament chess they were strong and dangerous, although uneven players. In lightning play they had few equals. This also applies to Lembit Ol, brackets 1966 to 1999, close brackets, the Estonian grandmaster who possessed a rare memory and was a brilliant theoretician, a man of similar fate who also suffered from a psychic disorder, and in the same way voluntarily departed from this life. The explanation suggests itself. The time allotted for play in a classical game allows one to sink into thought, generating doubts and uncertainty. For them, with their sharp falls in mood and excitable nervous system, this served only as a stimulus for mistakes and oversights. Blitz, however, demands instant reactions, while psychology and self-reproach retreat into the background. Here, they obviously thrive on their great natural talent. Any game of chess contains a wide range of emotions, with joys and vexations, great and small. These emotions accompany any type of creativity. But whereas in painting or literature it is possible to cross out, rewrite or change, in chess one movement of the fingers communicated by the mind is final. Often it can be repaired only by sweeping the wooden pieces off the board, or you can castigate yourself by hitting your head against a wall or by rolling around on the floor as one modern grandmaster does after losing a game. It is a rare game that develops with the smooth accumulation of an advantage and its conversion into a point. But even in this case, a player who is honest with himself knows what he was afraid of at a certain moment, what he was hoping for, and how he flinched after miscalculating a variation. Time and again, however, a game proceeds according to the following approximate pattern. Slightly worse, clearly worse, a mistake by the opponent, joy, winning chances, time trouble, missed opportunities, draw. Such changes in mood and emotion occur both in professional and in amateur play, with the only difference that, in the latter case, these sharp peaks of ascents and descents can be seen several times. A change of mood during the course of a tournament, although not in such an abrupt form as with Karen Grigorian, is also familiar to every player. "Even the way you walk has changed," said the observant David Bronstein in January 1976 in Hastings after I had managed to win a couple of games in a row. This sort of emotional stress and sudden decline during a game or during a tournament does not serve to strengthen the inner mental core. Chess, at top level, constantly shakes it, which can have far-reaching consequences, especially if this core is shaky or diseased. In no other type of sport does one encounter such a large number of peculiar people engrossed in themselves and living in their own world. What attracts them, with their shaky, unstable psyche, into this, by Nabokov's definition, complex, delightful, and useless art? Or is it the other way round? And is it chess that affects the psyche? You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website newinchess.com/magazine for more information about subscriptions and special offers. One does not have to turn to Vladimir Nabokov or Stefan Zweig. In the living gallery of chess of yesterday and today, it is not difficult to find geniuses or unfulfilled geniuses among this type of people. Torres' first steps were those of a future world champion, wrote Emmanuel Lasker at the start of the career of Carlos Torres, (1905–1978), the highly talented Mexican player who, at a young age, was forced to give up chess and to spend part of his life in a psychiatric clinic. Albin Planitch, who in his manner of play so resembled Tal, flashed across the chess firmament in the late 60s and early 70s and played brilliantly in tournaments. His career also did not last long. As a result of severe psychic disorder, he too had to give up chess and became a regular patient at a special clinic. But what are the boundaries of common sense, reason, normality? Clear reference markers are lacking. Often it's a question of frontier regions, in the thickets of which even psychiatrists lose their way. Vladimir Nabokov, who, by his own admission, took particular pleasure in composing suicide studies where white forces black to win, said in an interview on French television, "Yes, Fischer is a strange person, but there is nothing abnormal about a chess player being abnormal. This is normal." Take the case of Rubinstein, a well-known player of the early part of the century, who each day was taken by ambulance from the lunatic asylum where he stayed constantly to a cafe where he played, and then was taken back to his gloomy little room. He did not like to look at his opponent, but an empty chair at the chessboard irritated him even more. Therefore, in front of him, they placed a mirror, where he saw his reflection and perhaps also the real Rubinstein. Even in the years of his triumphs, the great Akiba liked to sit half-turned at the chessboard, as though keeping aloof from his opponent and playing only his own game. And is not the same aloofness from others and defence of his brittle ego to be heard in Rubinstein's words, "Tomorrow I am playing against the black pieces," in reply to a question about the name of his opponent in the next round? His nurse, Madame Rubin Zimmer, remembered, "He was an unusually calm and self-controlled person. He was easy to look after. Physically, he was exceptionally strong and very healthy for his age. But from time to time, he would behave strangely. For days on end, he would not come out of the room for even a short walk. Or sometimes in the evening, he would not want to go to bed. Then he would sit in the armchair next to the bed and meditate deeply about something or move the pieces on a pocket chess set." We do not know how the lessons went when the young O'Kelly went to the clinic to visit the famous maestro. What was Rubinstein thinking of when, in the very last period of his confinement, he would sit for a long time in front of a chessboard with the pieces set up in the initial position, sometimes making the move 1 c2 to c4 and taking the pawn back after half an hour's thought, again looking at the chessboard? What solution to the secret of the initial position did he imagine that he saw? It is hard to say how the life of a nervous and impressionable American youth would have turned out had he, after shining at university, based it in accordance with the inscription on his diploma. Paul Charles Morphy, Esquire, has the right to practice as a lawyer over the entire territory of the United States. The chess world would have lost one of its greatest geniuses, but perhaps he would not have spent the last 20 years of his life in a state of severe psychic disorder. The first world champion, Wilhelm Steinitz, who also ended his life in a psychiatric clinic, wrote, "Chess is not for the weak of spirit. It devours a person entirely. To get to the bottom of this game, he gives himself up to slavery." This voluntary, pleasant slavery went without saying for one of the most outstanding players of the last century. Robert Fischer expressed genuine surprise. What else is there? In response to a question by an interviewer as to what he did apart from chess, a champion gave the following explanation for his victories at the chessboard. "I devote 98% of my mental energy to chess. The others devote only 2%. To what use did he put the 2% of mental energy remaining after chess? From childhood, Fischer knew that money is good, that it is even better when there is a lot, and if possible, if this is expressed in figures with 6 noughts. But what to do with this money, with money in general? In the end, does it matter along the streets of which town, New York, Pasadena, or Budapest, you wonder, fearing the omnipresent journalists and photographers? After all, that other chess world, the only one, is always inside you, at any time of day and night, and at any point on the earth." Aristotle wrote, "Of the winners at the Olympic Games, only 2 or 3 gained victories both as boys and as mature men. The premature strain of preparatory exercises so exhausts one's strength that later, at a mature age, it is nearly always lacking." In our day, top chess demands even more all-devouring preparation, complete concentration, and aloofness from everything else. In the future, this tendency will only be intensified. Players will reach the summit and pass their peak well before 30. Too much nervous energy will have to be spent on preparation and struggle in the younger years. Giving the joy of creativity and sometimes prizes and money, chess at the very highest level demands a trifle in return: the soul. In the very last period of his life, Alvis Vitalins would still be in the club nearly every day, giving advice to anyone who asked him, playing blitz and analysing often until deep into the night. Sometimes he would even spend the night there. He was still gripped by a frenzied passion for analysis that could last for long hours or days, not distinguishing yesterday from the day before. For him, chess was never amusing. His life in chess, outside of everyday concerns, was his real life. He lived in chess, in solitude, as in a voluntary ghetto, and he felt uncomfortable outside the gates of this ghetto in the other big world, which was unreal and often hostile for him. In addition, he had reached the age of 50, and at this stage of his life, he must have felt that he was no longer needed by anyone. Material things became determining, and this material world, which he had always regarded with fear, menacingly impended over him. Vitalins was discarded by the Federation where he had been working as a trainer, for the simple reason that his job ceased to exist. It was not a question, of course, of the pennies that Alvis received there. His connections with the world collapsed. He had always been indifferent to what he ate and what he dressed in. While his parents were alive, this was their concern. They died within the space of 1 week, and on New Year's Eve 1996, the psychiatric Eglitis, also a chess player who had been treating Vitalins for free, also died. Ragged, unkempt and toothless, Alvis came to say goodbye, the day before carrying out his conscious decision to those who still remembered him. Only the following day did they realise what kind of a goodbye it had been. What did he think about on his last day? What is life for? What is the reason for this world? What is fate? What is chess? Did he say farewell to it, or, like Nabokov's hero, did he feel that the chessmen were pitiless? They held and absorbed him. There was horror in this, but in this also was the soul harmony, for what else exists in the world but chess, fog, the unknown, non-being? Did he remember the fatal jump of Karen Gregorian, who also rebelled against the conventional? Mor certa, hora certa, sed ignota. Brackets. Death is certain. Its hour is inevitable, but unknown. Close brackets. Ignota? Or did he subconsciously follow the advice of the ancients? The main thing is, remember that the door is open. Do not be cowardly, but like children when they do not like a game, they say, I won't play any more. So you too, when to you something feels the same, say, I won't play any more, and go away. Go away. And if you remain, don't complain. He had never complained about this life, but also he did not want to remain in it any longer. Sigulda is one of the most beautiful places in Latvia. Mysterious sandy caves, the ruins of medieval fortresses and castles, an enormous park with ancient oaks divided by the swift-flowing Gauja, with its precipitous banks. It's also good here in winter, where all is snowy and the trees are covered in hoarfrost. When the only thing sparkling in the sun is the white-blue ice of the hardened river, and it beckons to you, and there only remains the last jump. Like Lushin, who, at the instant when icy air gushed into his mouth, saw exactly what kind of eternity was obligingly and inexorably spread out before him. On a frosty day, February 16, 1997, Alvis Vitalins threw himself down onto this ice from the railway bridge spanning the Gauja River.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. We thank our voice actor, Nick Murphy, our producer, Alex Pollock, and of course our sponsor, DGT, for their support, and hope to have you back soon for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.